Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us for this Tuesday, the 28th of October. We're creeping toward Halloween and the end of the month. And very nice to have you with us. It is a just another cool, beautiful fall day. Our thoughts, of course, are with the people of Jamaica as they deal with this massive storm that is impacting them. And we certainly send our thoughts and prayers and just healing vibes to everybody there as they work through this very difficult time. And we hope that things perhaps go better than anticipated. So, but we'll talk a little bit about that later on. Let me introduce the group to you, and we'll get started for this morning. And very nice again to have us all together to discuss what's going on in our world. Teresa Bourgeois is here, public policy and communications expert. Good morning, Teresa. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning. I'm doing very well. And I say I've had some time up in Lake George in the Adirondacks the other day and just reminded how spectacularly beautiful it is and how lucky we are to live adjacent to the Adirondacks. It's just an extremely beautiful place. And thanks to all those who preserved it in the beginning and continuing to try to preserve it.
I know people have been talking about the fall not being as vibrant as it has been in the past, but in the last few days, with just a little bit of rain, and those colors have popped, and with that incredible sunshine, it has just been absolutely gorgeous. And I'm lucky enough to have a commute that brings me through, say, 70% of it, meaning that 70% of my commute has all of these gorgeous views. It takes me like 3 hours to get to work because I keep on stopping and taking pictures and stopping and taking pictures. It's just gorgeous.
Oh, it was magnificent. In fact, there were a couple of places where there's no reason that I should have stopped, but I kept thinking, okay, I can do it, right? It'll be safe. It was just, no, it wasn't.
Sort of safe.
But I was fortunate to have my brothers visiting from New Jersey and South Carolina and their spouses and kids. And it's just, the Adirondacks are spectacular. This whole area is beautiful. So, again, for all those who work to preserve it and keep it that way, and it's just a precious thing that we have and so lovely.
Thank you. Good to have you here. We also welcome Bob Brigham is with us. He is professor of history and international relations at Vassar College. Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine, Joe. Always good to be here.
Very nice to have you with us. Mike Spain is also going to join us, former Times Union Associated editor. We have a tracker on his car, and he's stuck in traffic. Yeah, that's right. We have an air tag on the car. He's close, but got into some traffic that was on the throughway, and we'll be here in just about 5 minutes or so. So we look forward to Mike Spain joining the conversation in just a little bit. I'm also thrilled to have a dear friend and someone that our listeners know very well, and to talk to us about, because one of the big stories coming out of as the shutdown grinds on is the SNAP benefits and money and food for the food insecure. And we have Natasha Pernicka with us, Executive Director of the Alliance for a Hunger-Free New York and the Food Pantries for the Capital District and founder of the New York State Food as Medicine Coalition. And it is a great pleasure to have you with us here this morning.
I am so grateful for the opportunity to have some conversation. Thanks for having me today.
Thank you very much. We welcome your letters as always, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Let's talk about this issue, which is hunger and cold loom as shutdown imperils funding for anti-poverty programs. Within days, tens of millions of low-income Americans may lose assistance for food, childcare, and utilities if the federal government remains closed. As the shutdown nears the one-month mark, the lapse in federal funding is a looming crisis for vulnerable Americans who depend. So this is the problem when you have one day off, because then you just the tongue doesn't work.
We're getting
there. You have to set it out, get it retyped, brought back, put in. A looming crisis for vulnerable Americans who depend on government assistance for basic needs like groceries and heating for 42 million people who rely on SNAP, or the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. We will refer to it as SNAP, but it stands for Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, also known as food stamps. It means the loss of grocery assistance when food banks are already stretched thin. For the 6.7 million women and children who participate in the Women, Infants, and Children Nutrition Program, or WIC, there is uncertainty about whether the Trump administration will find stopgap funds to help the program going after this week. So what do we do with this news, Natasha Pernicka?
I think that a lot of people don't understand the significance that SNAP plays for people in our community across the U.S. So it's 1 in 8 Americans that have SNAP benefits, and 1 in 4 children. And I am looking at you, and you're looking at me. So basically, there's 42 million Americans, and the thing about SNAP is that
I'm looking at you because I know the news is going to get worse.
Million Americans that have SNAP, and when we try to feed the hungry, we talk a lot about food pantries, but this is not a gap that can be filled with food pantries. The regional food bank recently released information. They serve 23 counties. And for an entire year, they distribute 54 million pounds of food. They ran some numbers, and SNAP provides 36 million pounds of food per month. You cannot make up the gap with food pantries and food banks. And unfortunately, we're caught in politics because although there is $6 billion in reserve that the USDA could tap into, they are playing politics with the states, telling states that they cannot use their own funds or they will not be reimbursed. And we're in a showdown over people having food to eat right now.
So let me ask this question, because as we look at what is being done as far as this issue in other states, let's look at what's happening in our state. The governor was out yesterday and said, Kathy Hochul, the Democratic governor of New York State, announced $30 million in emergency food assistance for New Yorkers as the federal government shutdown threatens to cut off supplemental nutrition assistance program for nearly 3 million residents. Hochul criticized U.S. House Republicans, including New York Representative Elise Stefanik, for refusing to reopen the government while food pantries warn they cannot meet surging demands. So, $30 million in emergency food assistance. How do we read that?
So, one of the great things about New York State is there is state funding currently that helps food banks and food pantries purchase food and healthy food. So that's a good thing. We are able to supplement the government food. However, the announcement that was made by Governor Hochul is distressing, because that money was already budgeted for this year. This money was not in response to the SNAP crisis that we're in. So, and keep in mind that the money that was budgeted this year in the state did not receive an increase to account for food inflation or service level increases that we've been experiencing. So basically, food pantries and food banks are doing more with less. And at a time where we're trying to raise private dollars right now to help us deal with this crisis, I'm having people come to me and say, oh, Governor Hochul is stepping up and helping you. And I'm having to say, we greatly appreciate what the state does, but this is not above and beyond what was already budgeted for.
And by the way, and from my understanding of this, Natasha, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but the $30 million was less than you were hoping for initially, right?
That's correct.
And it was already less than you needed, wanted, or could use to help the very real problems within the state of New York. Again, already budgeted. So when the governor comes in on the white horse and says, I bring you $30 million, you say, yes, you already gave that to us.
Yes, that's right. And honestly, $30 million doesn't even touch the money that's going to be needed. And that's where the real problem is that even you can't touch the amount of money that the state needs to cover SNAP for 1 month through food pantries.
So and also I'm not leading the witness, I promise, but I'm curious about this. But it then makes it more difficult, I think, for you and for food pantries across the state of New York, for hunger organizations, to then try to get more money when the thought is out there that they have somehow been saved by the state of New York.
I mean, that is a really important point. And that was part of the frustration, is because we are working together as best as we can, having emergency meetings and trying to raise private dollars. And if the federal government, USDA in particular, is refusing to release funds that they're capable of doing to make sure that people have SNAP assistance the first week of November, you know, even if the state kicks in a significant amount of money, we're still anticipating a delay. So at this point, either way, people are going to have nowhere else to turn to but food pantries. And so if the federal government's not going to do it, if the state doesn't have the ability to kick in additional funds, this is where we're at. This is community. And there's going to be gaps, and we're going to have to turn to rationing food. I would call this an emergency.
Teresa. Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead, Mike. Natasha, I just had one question. The $6 billion that the Department of Agriculture has for emergencies for the SNAP program, does that need congressional action, or is that just a decision that the administration needs to make to release those funds now?
So I was looking this up, and so apparently looking at precedent and how the Trump administration handled this in the past, they actually did release the funding in the past. So there's some really good information at the Center on Budget and Policy that really talks about the legality of it. It is saying that the administration's assertion that it cannot use SNAP's contingency reserves is contrary to the plain language of the law, prior Trump administration practice, and previous administration's understanding that contingency funds can be used during a shutdown. So precedent has been set in the past.
Teresa?
A couple things. One is, I think it's important to understand that the economic benefits for SNAP certainly apply directly to those who receive the SNAP benefits, but there is also an economic ripple effect through the economy. That's, I think, redundant what I just said, but there's a ripple effect through the economy because grocery stores benefit from this money, bodegas, corner stores, all those things. So that when you don't provide the SNAP benefits to the individuals, then they face some very serious, you know, food security issues. But it also impacts local businesses and on the other end, of obviously farmers and such who are providing the product. So I think that that's one thing that we need to think about, is the ripple effect that this has throughout the economy. The other thing is, I think that we have to think about this in the broader context of the Trump cuts, you know, what we've seen in the Trump proposed budget, because this is, as you may recall, maybe not, they already cut $186 billion out of the budget when they passed their bill earlier this year. So we're starting with a program from a deficit, a program that they want to cut even further. And the Trump administration's budget had proposed a even steeper cut. So I think that, you know, they're basically trying to pit people's health insurance against their food security. But it's more complicated than that because they're also, if you look at the Trump budget proposals, one is zero fund LIHEAP. So that's the funding for the heating assistance, so heating and cooling assistance. And there's also issues about Head Start, where both they pulled back funding for Head Start, they froze funding for Head Start. And Head Start is an important education program, but it's also daycare. So these same folks, you know, there's a really complex series of support systems that they are, with their budget cuts and with the indiscriminate cuts that Congress had not approved, you know, but they're freezing money, they're pulling back money in LIHEAP and housing. And so the food portion of this is part of an overall agenda that they have. And now they're saying, well, we're coming to the rescue of SNAP. It's the Democrats who are going to stop your SNAP benefits. Well, in fact, you know, what the Democrats are saying is come to the table, let's solve the healthcare crisis that's impending, right? And so I think that the key here is if the Republicans would come to the table, do their job, get these budgets passed, a lot of these issues, well, the deep cuts that they're proposing are not going to go away, but at least we'd be able to move forward on that which there is agreement. So I just think that this is the SNAP part is imminent, but as are the healthcare crisis will also have not only an impact on people's personal family kitchen table issues, but ripple also through the economy. And that's Trumpflation is bound to get much worse.
Bob?
I think this pain is real, but I also think the optics on this aren't favoring those people who want to, like all of us here, who want to help our neighbors. To me, this is a long, slow evolving crisis that, as Teresa says, starts with the cuts, and it just isn't just a factor of the budget slowdown and then in the government shutdown. I think part of the problem is that Trump and his administration doesn't really feel this pain in any way, even though 70% of the people who are at risk here of losing the subsidies for health care live in red districts. I don't think that's a concern for Trump. I don't think SNAP shortfalls are a concern for them. I think he's thinking that we just got $550 billion from Japan to invest in the United States. That's the headline today.
Right.
That in a storm. And that the optics on this are, I think, quite frankly, all in their favor. Schumer and Jeffries are bringing knives to a gunfight, and I think we're going to talk about this later. Even federal unions are starting to blame the Democrats for this. I just don't think they were prepared. I don't think that they're being strategic. And the tragedy of this is poor people are going to pay the price all across the board. Are paying the price, yes.
Mike?
The reality that all of these are connected, like you were saying, Teresa. You know, it just is going to have a devastating impact. And it's at a time when food assistance is needed for federal employees who are not getting paychecks. So already food distribution sites and food pantries across the country have been taxed to, especially like in New York and Washington, D.C., where there's a lot of federal employees, to do that. And this, I mean, it's like a perfect storm, I guess. It's just so many things happening at once. And just as you said, Bob, and the people that are going to pay the most are the poor.
I think that, too, when we think about who are people using SNAP assistance and food pantries, and we think of this idea of the poor, like there's a war on the poor. At this point in our society, wealth inequity has grown so great that it's working families. We have people where both parents are working and having to turn to food pantries. We have had retired people turning to food pantries who have never had to accept assistance before. We have a significant number of people with chronic health conditions and disabilities. The ABOD changes to SNAP, where they're increasing the number of people in households that have to have work requirements is really unacceptable and unrealistic. And that's one of the things we've been talking about is volunteer hours can count towards work. So is there a way for us to work on a community level to bring people who might not have opportunities in a traditional workforce to utilize skills that way?
It seems like 17 years ago, but it was just 2 weeks ago that you and I were on the air together talking about the food pantries and raising money for the radio station as well as for food pantries of the Capital District. But one of the things that we heard from the people who were calling in, well, these were people who had 2-3 jobs and still needed these benefits desperately to keep going. And I just think that's something that really needs to be underscored.
You can add to that list military families.
That's right. Absolutely. And military families and just how veterans are being treated is just staggering.
Yeah, I think this issue of, you know, look, the bigger picture is this growing economic inequality. And that's not going to get solved in the next few weeks. But I do think that we have to keep assessing that. I saw there's a 2024 report by the Center for Urban Economic Development that they looked at major corporations who rely on government subsidies for their workers, right? So the just a data point, 1/3 of Amazon warehouse workers, 33%, have used one or more public assistance programs. SNAP usage within that group of 23% of Amazon workers have used supplemental nutrition assistance programs. A 2020 GEO report listed a number of major corporations whose employees rely on these various subsidies. So these SNAP, Medicaid, Head Start, so on and so forth. And so there is a bigger issue of a livable wage and what people earn. And these companies, whether it's Walmart or Amazon, or there's a whole list of them in these reports, of what they are paying their workers. And is it a livable wage? Can you meet all these demands? Because as you say, all the data shows a lot of these people are working, including military families.
I want to go back to something Bob said that I think is really important of this idea of bringing a knife to a gunfight. That's right.
Yeah.
I was thinking it was the other way. No, that doesn't work. But what you said is that the big story, the stories today are Japan and the storm.
And China. Pending trade deal with China that is a result of an escalation that de-escalates to where we were before any of this started.
Okay, so I promise we can get to that. I promise. But what I just want to focus on before we take a break is this idea that with you would hope that eventually, as more people are impacted, and it becomes closer to home for so many people, that this would become a larger issue. I have learned from you, Natasha Pernicka, that unfortunately, the poor and those who need these programs are the first to be really overlooked, and it's difficult for them to get a seat at the table.
What has happened is that food has also become politicized, and if anybody has seen the USDA website, it is directly in violation of the Hatch Act, which prohibits the use of government resources for partisan ends. So if you are a person who is going to the USDA SNAP website looking for information, the first thing you read at the top of the page, this is on the USDA website. It says, Senate Democrats have now voted 12 times to not fund the food stamp program. The USDA is using the website. So for a SNAP participant, that's got to be very confusing. I do want to speak to, Teresa was talking about the return on investment of SNAP. So you're talking about people take the SNAP benefits and go to grocery stores. There's actually been research that shows there's a $1.50 return on investment with SNAP benefits. So not only is it SNAP recipients who are going to lose out, and we recently surveyed food pantry guests, And here in our area, here in the Capital District, 46% of food pantry guests who were surveyed also received SNAP assistance. The average benefit was $281 a month. So that means at the beginning of November, you're not going to have this resource going through our grocery system. The grocery retailers are going to hit. But you know who's going to make out okay on this? The corporate food manufacturers, because they're not going to lose profits, because you know what they're going to do, what they did during COVID, is they're going to increase the cost of food.
Right.
So since 2019, if you compare October 2019 before pandemic to October of this year, there's a more than 30% increase in grocery inflation. So that means regular people who can still shop at a grocery store are going to be spending more money for the same products. Grocery retailers who food pantries look to for donations of product and financial support, they're going to be hit. And so this ripple effect, you know, you talk about the truckers required to move food to the groceries. I mean, it's really the effect and the impact of this irresponsible political behavior and finger pointing is a self-made situation. Like, there were choices and people in positions of power that made decisions and choices to play the game out in this way, and they didn't have to. I think that's the bottom line, is that there is money in reserves that could be used, and the emotional stress and strain on 42 million Americans and all of the charitable food providers, I consider it abuse.
Including active military, including veterans. And, you know, I absolutely agree with you. And also family farmers. But we talk about, you know, China's the issue of the day. Well, what's the issue with China right now? One of the issues is it's the trade tariff fight. Right. So the tariff fight, what is the result of one of the key results of the tariff fight is the impact on our cattle farmers, right? And soybeans. China's retaliation to the Trump tariffs is, okay, we won't buy soybeans from you anymore.
But in this what looks to be trade deal, both those issues are going to be taken care of.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
We've solved the problem that we created.
No, but in fact, it's not going to be taken care of for the soybean farmers because
the harvest is coming. And
because they've missed the harvest. Yeah. They've moved to the market, the Argentine market, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And so the soybean farmers have lost their market. They have 2 billion I heard it yesterday, 2 pounds. They have an enormous amount of surplus.
Gazillion pounds.
They have a gazillion pounds of surplus that's in warehouses. And they've now, they need to be able to sell that. But because of Trump's decisions on imposing these tariffs, they lost that market. And we will all pay for that at the grocery store with Trumpflation.
We're gonna pause there, and we'll take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation. We welcome your letters. panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We're talking about the government shutdown imperiling SNAP and other anti-poverty programs. We have a terrific panel this morning. Mike Spain is here, Bob Brigham, Teresa Bourgeois, and Natasha Pernicka, Executive Director of the Alliance for a Hunger-Free New York and the Food Pantries for the Capital District, and founder of the New York State Food as Medicine Coalition. Natasha is with us till 10 o'clock this morning. So, Natasha, let me ask you, as we talk about this issue, you are obviously on the ground with the food pantries and dealing with this the best way you can. As an activist, what can be done? What can we do? You're on the front lines. What else can we do to try to deal with the problems at hand? And the most important thing, of course, is getting people the resources they need.
One of my experiences in advocacy is that I have never seen anti-hunger advocates as coordinated as they are today in the past couple of years, national, state, local, working collectively, because we don't, you know, we don't want you to take from this program to give to this program, right? Like, we want all of the programs to be fully funded. And so, you know, my initial reaction is to make some noise to both the Republicans and the Democrats and let them know it's completely unacceptable to let people go without SNAP. However, I say that, but we have been so well organized and coordinated that I feel like regular strategies and tactics are not making the impact that we really need to see happen right now. I think that we are returning to a place of rationing food for people who are going to experience losing significant dollars at the beginning of the month. And when we talk about community helping community, that's what we're left with, is community helping community. And a lot of public representatives have been using that. A lot of charities have been using that concept of community helping community. But I want to remind people that back in the 1970s, when it was community helping community, before we had major Feeding America food banks, we had community helping community, and it was not enough. It wasn't enough then. Community still can't replace what the federal dollars can do. And also, it's not our responsibility. Food should be recognized as a human right. The United States is one of the few countries that does not recognize food as a human right, but it is. So we need to put the pressure on, in particular, to both the Republicans and the Democrats, honestly, at this point, to say enough is enough, put party politics aside, and get down to business.
Am I correct? And I have two questions for you. One is the idea of food rationing. What does that look like?
Well, we were talking about this because we're having a crisis meeting today with our Capital Region food pantries to talk about who has capacity, who doesn't have capacity. Our pantry members are saying, well, can I serve more people or do I serve less people and give more food? Right. And so we also have made such progress over the years in getting healthy, fresh foods, fruits and vegetables, meats and dairy. However, if you're a person sitting at home and you're looking at your cabinet and you have some spaghetti, some pasta sauce and some oatmeal, and you don't know if you're going to have SNAP benefits, shelf stable foods, you can ration them throughout a month. Right. That lettuce is going to wilt. If you don't use that fruit, it's going to go bad. But you, as an individual at home, can ration shelf-stable food items. These are literally the conversations that we're having today and this week and last week.
I yield my remaining time to the gentlewoman from Cohoes.
I just want a question really for you. How do we prevent the, you know, Trump Vance vote administration from pitting the health security people against the food security people? Because that's the dynamic they're trying to set up here, is pitting the health security people against the food security people. Do you protect people's health care coverage, or do you provide food, LIHEAP benefits? How do you, as advocates, prevent that, allowing them to do that?
It is completely unacceptable to pit health versus food. In fact, when you look at a person's health, 80% of a person's health is determined by the social determinants of health, not medical care. Social determinants of health are nutritional quality of food, consistent access to food, quality of your housing, do you have lead paint or not, safety in your neighborhood, your family's income level. Those social determinants of health impact a person's health more than the medical care that they receive. Medical care is important. I'm not saying it's not. But if we are taking food away from Americans, you are going to see spikes in issues with diabetes. You're going to see an increase in emergency visits. Hospital emergency room visits. You can't separate the two. We formed the Food as Medicine Coalition because there's Medicaid opportunities from federal to provide resources to bolster Medicaid with social care interventions like medically tailored prepared meals, like medically tailored groceries, veggie prescriptions. So you cannot do that. And so that is where we need to continue to say you can't pit food versus health care. And the politicians that are doing that are irresponsible. They're irresponsible.
Well, that's clearly the Republican play right now, right? That's the Trump administration play right now. Because, as you say, they do have this pot of money that they could tap into. Or they could do what they were supposed to do, which is come to the table and negotiate these things, right? Just like there's no defense budget, defense appropriations budget. Why? Because the Republicans in the House and the Republicans in the Senate, they both pass bills. They can't come together and reach agreement among the Republicans, let alone with the Democrats. But the solution to this is that they get to the table. Mike Johnson brings the House back in. They've been out of session for a month now, right? Maybe 5 weeks, Mike?
It's a month.
Month,
whatever,
yeah.
Right?
It is a month, yes.
Come to the table, and they could vote, I think, to release that, to direct the Trump administration to release the money. But we can't let them pit these two groups against each other.
Right. I was just going to say they would have to have Democratic, if they ran, the House would have to come back, and the Senate would have to get some more Democrats if it was going to be a one-shot bill to release these emergency funds that USDA has that it could now commit administratively towards SNAP. You know, it gets very complicated. And then if Johnson were to bring back the House, he'd have to swear in the Arizona congresswoman who elect. And that might mean that the Jeffrey Epstein papers would go public, and that's another embarrassment. I mean, the whole thing is such a complicated mess.
But we're going to destabilize the food security and health security in this country so the Epstein files don't come out?
Well, what's going to happen?
Yes. Isn't that really what's going on here?
What is going to happen when people are hungry?
Yeah, No.
It is...
But what's going to happen when they get their notices in the next few weeks about their health insurance premium, and they have to decide, am I going to not sign up or am I going to sign up for health insurance?
Well, and that's that's what I really want to focus on, too, is that we are at a point, we are seeing, I yield to you the being the expert here, but Natasha, but we're seeing a tip of an iceberg coming out of the water. But below that, as it is emerging out of the depths of the sea, is this problem is going to get worse and worse and worse and worse, because we're seeing it every day. I live in a rural area. You see the hunger. You see the food insecurity. You see the incredible increase of need of pantries. You see the cost of groceries skyrocketing in addition to the cost of everything else. So what I guess if you took a snapshot in time and said, like, how do we deal with this now with what we have? Okay, that's one thing. But this problem is only going to get progressively worse.
This is at a time where our politicians need to be leaders, and we have a moral obligation to fund all of the social safety network programs. Teresa listed a whole bunch of programs that have been disrupted or at risk earlier in our conversation. We, as an American society, have lifted people, significant numbers of people, out of poverty because of federal safety net programs, including WIC, SNAP, HEAP. You were talking about Head Start programs. These programs have literally lifted people out of poverty. You can't pit these things against each other because they work hand in hand as our federal social safety net. And if you're not going to hold corporate America accountable for funding living wages, if we are not going to have government health care like many other civilized societies do, and we're going to push the burden of health care as a for-profit institution onto companies and individuals, if you as a federal government are going to exist this way, and then you're going to pull the social safety network programs, we are going to have historic levels of poverty that we have not seen in decades in this nation. And then what are we going to do?
But I think that's...
Let me just go.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay.
No, I mean, I think that that's, you talked about a knife to a gunfight, but so I'm not quite sure on that. I think that's one of the things that the Senator Schumer and others are trying to create, this forcing function, because all of this, you know, slashing and cutting of all these programs across the board, that's exactly what they're trying to do. Russ Vought and the Project 2025 people believe you don't need all of these things, right? That these all these things should go away. And so they have cut them by the, you know, Elon Musk initial, you know, those folks coming through and cutting across the board. And then through the bill where they actually did it legally, and now through withholding, you know, pulling back funds, freezing funds. And it's all people, you know, they didn't see it, they didn't feel it. But now there are all of these deadlines, and they're about to see it and about to feel it, and people have a choice.
As one of those people, like millions of Americans who was lifted out of poverty from the Great, by the Great Society programs, I was in foster care, we were dependent. When I finally got adopted, my parents divorced, and I was raised by a single woman, and we were on stamps. That was the beauty of America and the Great Society, helping total strangers. But I agree with Teresa. I don't think the agenda here is to do much else. And I think the political optics on this are not pleasant. For the pain that's real and that people are feeling right now to have political consequences, at best, it's probably 10 months out. But if you look at what the Republicans are doing right now in this administration, they're controlling this narrative beautifully. I mean, they are really doing their job. It's all horizon stuff. It's third term stuff. It's the trade deal with Asia. It's the ASEAN meetings. You know, the military is getting taken care of. So the day to day pain that ordinary Americans are feeling right now isn't going to have political ramifications until I think Schumer and Jeffries stop treating this like it's a Harvard Law Review debate and get after this. Everything that they bet the farm on as a leverage point, it's not a leverage point.
Let me ask the question of Natasha, of, because you were, I mean, you were in talking about how this will become just a huge problem. To Bob's point of what he's saying, is there, I'm glad to hear from you that the organizations and the activists and those food pantries and working for the food insecure and SNAP and so forth are motivated and are coming together like never before. That's wonderful news. Is there leadership beyond that, a political leadership that is helping, that someone that you can go to say, okay, well, at least this person has our back?
I think that in general, and I'm going to be real clear that I'm from a nonpartisan organization, right? We don't get involved in partisan politics, but in general, Democrats have been more open to listening to conversations about SNAP and have taken the lead publicly on that. I think one of the myths that we need to bust is the largely Republican narrative, is that there's jobs out there and people just need to get a job. I have tried to have living wage and benefit cliff conversations with Republican representatives, and they don't want to hear it. They don't want to hear the reality of the wages. There's this myth that if you work hard enough, you should be able to make ends meet. And it's just not true in this day and age. And I don't know. I have tried hard to share real information and facts and stories from real people who are working, and I'm not getting through the narrative. And I'm at a loss at this point, other than to continue sharing the facts, continue to sharing the impact it's having on real individuals' lives, that these are people that are working, they are people that can't work, they're retired. This concept of laziness is absolutely inappropriate to put on the struggling Americans and community members right now. So I think as long as we are allowed to have the right to speak freely in this country, I will continue to be vocal I don't know what else to do from here.
Let me ask you a question, and I know I would normally ask this off the air, but we have a bunch of letters. I know you have to go. Do you want to stay 10 minutes and listen to some of the letters?
I'm happy. Yeah, I'm happy to stay.
Or do you want to head out now?
Don't kick me out.
I'm not kicking you out. I'm asking you. I never want you to leave. I always want you here.
Yeah, I can stay 10 minutes. Thank
okay.
you.
So we're going to take a break, and we'll be back, and I'll have you out by 10:15. How's that sound?
Sounds great.
All
Thank
right.
you.
We'll be back right after this. That was one of the livelier breaks I remember in a long time. It was a good. I'm sorry you missed it because it was a really good discussion. But we'll try to replicate it the best we get as we come back with our wonderful group this morning. Government shutdown imperils SNAP and other anti-poverty programs is the New York Times article that we started with this morning, and we've been discussing this with Theresa Bourgeois, Bob Brigham, Natasha Pernicka, and Mike Spain. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. I promised I'd have Natasha out in a few minutes here, so let me get to the letters that we have this morning that I want to share with all of you. Growing up in the USA, we were taught that we live in the greatest country in the world, America. My brother spent his life working in group homes with disabled individuals. Most times, he worked two jobs and he saved enough to buy a small home. Now this man who lives on $1,450 a month sits in his home trying to figure out how to eat next month. In our case, it is true, he ain't heavy. He is our brother, and he will not go without any necessities. However, not everyone has a supportive family, a family who can afford to help them, or family at all. Hey, wait, we live in the greatest country in the world. Wait, surprise, maybe we don't. A once proud American, Cheryl, wrote that letter as she self-identifies. We go to this letter from Sue. Where can we send donations to the food bank?
Joe, thefoodpantries.org.
Foodpantries.org, that is the organization here in the Capital District, the foodpantries.org. It's the organization that we have worked with for so long during our fund drives. We say this every single solitary fund drive, and we'll say it again. Whatever organization, if you have a food pantry in your backyard that is not under the umbrella of the food pantries of the Capital District, then I swear to you, I promise you, if you call them and say, I have money for you, they will take it.
Yeah. And at thefoodpantries.org, we have a state of local community food pantries across the entire state. There's a map at thefoodpantries.org. So you can go and find the food pantry right in your neighborhood. Also, just if you're not in New York State, just Google food pantry and you'll find one in your own community to help.
That's right.
And the Teresa point during the break was that as nice as it is to give canned goods and things out of your pantry to the food bank, they can really maximize their impact if you donate cash.
Right. With the dollars, they can go and make it go much, much further. Sue, thank you very much for that note. How I wish that our Democratic representatives would speak to the fact that many people work and have SNAP benefits. This would stop the chanting and ranting and raving about people getting free handouts and doing nothing. That from Anne. I don't know if it would stop it, but it certainly.
They do that, though. They have been holding up, bringing people to. I know I'm incessant about this, but it's. I know it's not breaking through. But they have, in fact, there was a hearing in Washington the other day where they had folks, and I know that Congressman Tonko here has stood with working families and military families and others. But we all have to echo that. We all have to be the voice.
Yeah, I agree with you. I understand, and this is policy stuff, and we're in the weeds on the policy stuff. But most of America isn't in the weeds on the policy stuff, and that's what worries me. Is there's real need here, there's real pain here, there's real suffering here. And I feel like that pain and suffering isn't as part of the national conversation as it should be.
Let's go to James. It's long past time to stop playing politics over the health of Americans. Democrats need to end the shutdown and then broadcast loud and clear on a daily basis that the Republicans are refusing to come to the table to solve the health care deficit that is hurting the American people. Make these people do their job. That from James. We then go to this letter from Susan. In Saugerties, this government cannot be trusted to maintain any benefits for the people. How about paying our federal taxes to the state to use to maintain SNAP, school lunches, and food banks and other programs that constitute the social safety net? The state can be the model for truly progressive taxes and for a single-payer health plan. This administration's goal is to eliminate the social safety net, period. That from Susan. Let's go to this letter from Anne. How I wish that our Democratic representatives, I think I already read, no, I didn't. How I wish that our Democratic representatives would speak to the fact that many people, no, I did read
you
that.
Did.
I was saying double whammy there. So who cares about SNAP, writes John. Who cares about fellow Americans going hungry? Sure, I do, Joe does, the panel does. But Republicans absolutely do not care about the poor. They demonize the poor constantly, so they clearly do not care about them going hungry. And politicians in general don't care. They only pay lip service and pretend to care when their voters care. And as I said, who cares about the poor? That from John.
The ironic thing there is, if you look, I looked at a map today showing where per capita food assistance goes, and so much of it is in rural red states, rural counties around the country, and those are white poor people who are overwhelmingly voting Republican, and it doesn't make sense, but it's true. The Republicans are getting supported by people who are getting direct impact from these cuts.
And that's not something new.
No,
I mean, this
nope.
is we can go back to the Reagan years when steel workers were voting against their economic interests daily in support of Reagan and some of his anti-steel policies. This is a systemic problem, and it's going to take. I mean, one of the letter writers said, "Stop playing politics." I actually have the reverse view. Play politics harder. Remember what you are.
We are all the voice that we're all waiting to hear, right? I mean, it's up to us.
Yeah.
Really, we are that voice that could raise, you know, the discussion and say you can't pit the healthcare people against the food security people.
That was poetic.
Yeah, but it's all nuanced. I mean,
I really believe that. We're all saying, why isn't somebody else talking? It's us, right? It's up to us. It's up to us to convey the stories. A bunch of people, we're all going to get letters soon. Well, I got my letter saying my health care, the plan's not going to be available anymore. I got to go find it somewhere else, right? So as people get those letters, or they get their letters that say that their, you know, their rates are going up, or as the military families who are on SNAP, you know, most people don't realize how many military families rely on SNAP.
Mike, you want to say?
Well, no. I was just going to say there's not an easy soundbite that contradicts the, the Trump administration's soundbites. You know, the Democrats caused all this and blah, 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 and we're doing all this good stuff. It's too often a longer explanation. Bob, I mean, I think you were getting to some of that. I mean, you know, we need to have unity. I listened to a little bit of the rally the other night at that they had in New York City for the mayoral race, Mondami, and he captures it. AOC captures it. Bernie Sanders captures it, and the crowd goes wild. More skilled messengers have to be out there. I don't think Hakeem Jeffries and Chuck Schumer are getting that kind of messaging across.
But, Mike, you don't understand. Bad Bunny is performing at the Super Bowl, and this is going to ruin America.
I understand. I understand.
It's just unbelievable.
He's like the first American citizen in a long time. I don't care about that.
Yeah, Mike,
Jay says, you don't want to be having an American citizen performing at the Super Bowl, do you? Sorry.
If the House is still getting paid, why aren't they forced to be in D.C. negotiating when they're supposed to be in session? That from Jay. And finally, from Ann in Millbrook, I've been buying extra at Costco to put in my church's food pantry. But I take your word of dollars buying much more food if we donate to our food pantries and food banks. And now is the time, friends, send a check. And that is from Anne. I will remind you of how to do it for Natasha's wonderful organization, the Food Pantries of the Capital District. You go to thefoodpantries.org. There is information there to help other organizations nearby, and you can always just go and Google a food pantry in your region and help them out as well. Again, thefoodpantries.org. Also, a ton of information on there about the great work that is being done by Natasha and her organization, so you can find out more and sort of watch as things go through the process here at thefoodpantries.org. Natasha Pernicki, the executive director, she is a man, you're the best, and I hate that we're having this war and this fight, but I'm really glad we got you as the soldier that's out there fighting. So thank you so much for everything you're doing.
You make me cry. And I want to be really clear that I'm here today and have the honor and the privilege to be here, but it's everybody out there doing this.
You're the best. Thank you so much for sharing your time being with us.
And you are awesome.
It's wonderful to have you here. And let me know. Come on back. You're welcome anytime. Come on back. We'll talk about this again. I don't think we can talk about it enough. Natasha Pernicki, you can find out more information by going to thefoodpantries.org, thefoodpantries.org. Mike, can we take a quick break, and we'll be right back after that. Thanks. Oh, thanks so much to Natasha Pernicka for the wonderful work she does. And she is amazing and just a ray of sunshine and a really tough thing that we get to discuss on the program. The music we've been hearing this morning, I want to make mention of this too, is drummer Jack DeJohnette, who was just a standout jazz artist and instrumentalist for the past five decades. And a semi-frequent guest on this program, an amazing musician, an amazing human, kind, gentle, just a beautiful person, and we loved him very, very much. And he died on Sunday in Kingston. He was 83 years old. We're playing his music in his memory this morning. And very much miss him, and we send our regards to his friends and family, who certainly are feeling his loss today. But Jack DeJohnette, standout jazz drummer, passing away on Sunday at the age of 83. All right, let's get back to other issues in the news and talk about other stuff. We're not going to go too far from where we were and touch on some of these things. Bob mentioned this earlier, and I think it's a major story when we talk about the shutdown of what it's going to take. And one of the things that we see, I see this as a crack, right, is that the largest union of federal workers called on Monday for Congress to pass a spending bill to immediately end the government shutdown, effectively siding with President Trump and Republicans who have opposed Democratic efforts to restore health care spending. Both political parties have made their point, and still there is no clear end in sight, says Everett Kelly, the president of the American Federation of Government Employees. He added, it's time to pass a clean, continuing resolution to end the shutdown today. No half measures and no gamesmanship. The statement was a remarkable shift for the union. Before the shutdown began on October 1st, Mr. Kelly called on Republicans to negotiate with Democrats who were seeking concessions, including the extension of subsidies for plans under the Affordable Care Act that would stave off premium increases and the loss of coverage for millions of Americans. The union has also worked closely with Democratic lawmakers on efforts this year to oppose Mr. Trump's policies particularly his wide-reaching campaign to slash the federal workforce and fire career civil servants. Again, this reporting from the New York Times, amid the punishing effects of the shutdown on federal workers, however, some 730,000 are working without pay, and another 670,000 are furloughed entirely. Senate Democrats have blocked legislation that would pay the civil servants who have been working without pay, a move that would provide relief to the union's members, but would weaken the bargaining position of Democratic lawmakers. The Republicans, in turn, blocked a pair of Democratic bills that would have paid both those federal workers who are still working and those who have been furloughed. They're working for America. Mr. Trump seized on those votes to try to drive a wedge between Democrats and the federal workers' unions, asserting that Democrats don't want the workers to be paid at all, though Mr. Trump himself previously signaled that he might try to deny some workers back pay after the shutdown ends. The president invited Senate Democrats to cross party lines and vote for the Republican proposal to reopen the government. Bob.
I think it's only a matter of time. I think the Trump administration has owned the messaging on this, and Schumer and Jeffries have really punted. And I think the place that they've punted and where they haven't seemed to be able to get out in front of is that for the average American, not for the policy wonks, not for people who do this for a living, but for the average American, it seems as if Schumer is intent on saving a program that's not perfect over people. That may be a bad interpretation of the reality, but I think that's how the message is hitting. And I think that the union is feeling that. If this is just about Obamacare, which it's not, but if that's the messaging that it is, they're saving an imperfect program at the expense of people, and they can't get out in front of that message.
Mike Spann.
Yeah, I think you articulated quite
I'm
well.
Sorry, Mike 3. Mike.
Oh. I'm sorry. I think, Bob, you articulated quite well. It is. Obamacare is a imperfect system that has been made less perfect over the years by Congress and by the administration, the Trump administration. They'd like to blow it up, and they're gradually doing that, and this is another step in that direction. And the Democrats do seem to be losing the rhetorical fight. They seem to be losing momentum. Although initially I think there was a lot of polling showing that people were blaming the Republicans. They were blaming Mike Johnson for not convening. I think one of your writers, letter writers, Joe, one of the listeners pointed out, we have Congress that are being paid. Why aren't they back at the job working a solution to this? And it's that their leadership is not letting them. And that message was coming across, but you can see if the Federal Workers Union is now officially asking that they end this effort, that Schumer and Jeffries end this effort, it means they're capitulating because of an awful lot of pressure on them. They are suffering. They are working without pay, or they're not working at all and not sure they're going to ever get the back pay. It's a very, very difficult situation, and we just talked about how difficult times are already for the first part of this program. So I think it's in self-interest, in desperation. You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of the Air Traffic Controllers Union back in the 1980s that Reagan busted. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like everybody was supporting them, and all the unions were supporting them, and little by little it just kind of withered. And it was a political victory for Reagan, but I think it really hurt our air traffic control system, and we're paying for it today.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And I think that part of the problem is in the early calculation, and Schumer said this publicly, every day of the shutdown is better for Democrats.
Well, and that hurts.
That really hurts.
Bad, that is bad messaging. Yeah. And I think they're holding out till Saturday, figuring that by November 1st, people will be getting the notices, if they haven't already, and a lot have not yet, on what their health care plan, their Obamacare version, whatever state they're in, will the Medicaid subsidy program that they're in, the premiums will double or more. And that I think the Democrats are hoping will jar people into realizing how awful this is and that they have to step in to do it. But it doesn't feel like that's sticking. Yeah.
Teresa Bourgeois.
So I've heard this narrative on the panel over the last few weeks, this sort of the same undertones of Democrats are bad, Democrats are bad.
Messaging is bad.
Honestly, it just, I'll be honest, I feel like I'm operating on a different universe because it blows my mind. I'm just sort of, not to say that in a denigrating way, but just it totally confuses me because...
Well, I think this union is a prime example of it. They're losing their people because their messaging is not good.
So the Democrats have been saying... So you say, well, it's an imperfect program. So, well, 20 millions and millions of people are now insured as a result of Obamacare, right? So maybe it's not perfect, and the Democrats say it's not perfect, but it has brought millions and millions of people under the umbrella of insurance, right? And the Republicans have no alternative. They have never been able to come to consensus among Republicans, let alone a broader consensus about it. And because of... they have not been able to kill it outright, so they're trying to do it in a backdoor way, and we should not let them get away with that. And so I heard former Congressman Faso the other day here talking about this and saying, well, these were COVID era subsidies,
yeah,
and they're set to expire because COVID's been gone for a long time, so they're supposed to expire. Well, in the Republican bill that they passed earlier this year, all of the tax subsidies, they were made permanent. The health subsidies, they're temporary. So does that mean that former Congressman Faso and all these others think that all those subsidies should go away at the next date when there's 20? If they don't act now, 24 million people will lose the insurance they have now, plus other people's rates will go up very high. And we're about to see what the Democrats have been warning about for a while. People are about to get the letters that show dramatic, catastrophic increases in their premiums. And so, of course, the Republicans want to stop this before then, right? But this, you know, this is where the rubber hits the road.
I don't disagree with a thing you've said. The problem is that's you and me talking, and it's the good listeners talking, but in the vast stretch of American politics, that message is not getting through.
But it's where it shifts from Republican, shall we say, messaging or propaganda to the reality of people's lives, including the lives of many Republicans. The lives of many Republicans in red states who rely on these health care, particularly rural Republicans, rely on this health care funding. Or SNAP funding or whatever. So I think, you know, this is really a fundamental question of the role of government in our lives. And the Republicans say we don't need it and move it back to the states. The states don't have the funding for it. And we're at a major juncture here. And we can give up and say no, you know, and let 24 million people lose their subsidies. Or we can say come to the table.
We're going to take a break. We'll continue this conversation. When we get back, we'll wrap up. As we return, we welcome your letters as always. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning, all. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion as we finish up for this edition, the Tuesday edition of the program, October 28th, 2025. It's 34 minutes past 10 o'clock. So we have Teresa Bourgeois, Bob Brigham, and Mike Spain with us, and we welcome you. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. Okay, so let's go. We have about a few more minutes here, so let's go. And I want to go to the story about Well, one of the things, this is, again, getting back to what we were talking about before with Natasha. So there was a Zoran Mamdani rally yesterday, and Governor of New York State, Kathy Hochul, went to this. This was at Arthur Ashe Stadium and in New York. And in New York City, which is why a candidate for mayor of New York would be campaigning there. And it was meant to be a friendly appearance, a chance for Kathy Hochul to speak to a stadium filled with progressive-minded New Yorkers who had come out to rally for Zoran Mamdani in the final days of the campaign. It did not go particularly well, writes the New York Times. Ms. Hochul mispronounced Mr. Mamdani's name not once, but four times. By the time the governor built to what should have been the climax of her speech, a commitment to universal child care, one of Mr. Mamdani's most ambitious priorities, the crowd at Forest Hill Stadium in Queens had become downright rowdy. Tax the rich, they cried, drowning out the governor. Tax the rich, tax the rich, tax the rich. Ms. Hochul smiled and waited. Well, this crowd is fired up, she chuckled. 5 minutes went by, then 10. As the chanting continued, all right, she said finally, flashing a guarded smile, I can hear you. The moment was an apt encapsulation of the political bind that Ms. Hochul finds herself in as she launches her campaign for a second term as governor of New York State. Facing a contested primary and general election, Ms. Hochul would relish the type of adulation and excitement that Mr. Mamdani has generated. But the governor, a Democrat from Western New York, is a centrist, a political stance that does not resonate with the ascendant left in New York City, which forms Mr. Mamdani's political base. Over the past 4 years, Ms. Hochul has championed policies opposed by the left, from deploying the National Guard to the subway to strengthening the state bail law. And while the state Senate and Assembly have repeatedly proposed raising taxes on the rich, Ms. Hochul has flatly rejected the idea as a non-starter, a portent of significant fiscal challenges for Mr. Mamdani's affordability proposals. A lot here, Mike.
Yeah, it's going to be a very interesting race for governor next year. But already, I think that rally in Forest Hills over the weekend should scare the bejesus out of most mainstream Democrats who are kind of middle of the road, like Kathy Hochul, the governor of New York. You know, ordinarily when a mayoral candidate gets the governor endorsing him, that is something that elevates the candidate, the mayoral candidate. In the case of Kathy Hochul, I think she was trying to lift her own status by endorsing Mamdani. And I thought she had a little bit, but she was certainly not warmly received at a rally where Alexander Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie Sanders spoke first before Mamdani got on the podium and just electrified the crowd. So her own reception really stood in contrast to that, and it demonstrates the challenge that moderate and middle of the road Democrats are going to have going forward.
Yeah, I agree with Mike. It's an interesting mix here of progressivism and kind of traditional Democratic. And the only issue is, can you scale that up? I mean, AOC has a district. He has a city. Can you do something like that statewide? And it seems to be where the big question marks still are. And then when we throw Jeffries and Schumer in there, this is a really interesting mix of New York politicians all.
Now, Jeffries just endorsed Mamdani.
He did.
Right?
He did.
But Schumer has yet to endorse.
I don't think he has. Yeah. And I think the political calculation is that where the state party is is that where Democrats in New York have to go, or is that where they're looking?
Right. And when the election does happen next year, and it's likely going to be against Congresswoman Elise Stefanik, the Republican, who's been, campaigning to be the nominee for the Republican Party, will the middle of the road Democrats and will the progressive Democrats band together to defeat Stefanik and elect Hochul, or it'll all be about turnout and enthusiasm? And that's one of the problems that Democrats are having right now, is raising that's enthusiasm right. across the whole party,
exactly.
not just the progressives, who are really fired up.
So I think part of the point you're making, I'll say it a little bit differently. That is a part of the Democratic coalition, but it's not all of the Democratic coalition. And that's a part of the Democratic coalition that regularly breaks through. But to win, as President Obama became President Obama, because he understood that you had to knit together a much broader coalition than that. That was a key, but it had to be much broader than that. What I heard in those chants, I think, is something that we were talking about earlier, which is this, the angst, and I think this ripples through a lot of these issues, this angst between the growing gulf between the growing economic divide, which is, as Bob Reich and others have been raising the concern about for a long time, is getting to be a very, dangerous place in our country about the top tiny percent who control most of the wealth and most of the power in this country and the others. And that has generated enormous angst. And the question now is, how do we respond as a country to this moment? And do we respond in the way that the Democrats think we should, by providing some sort of safety nets and health security, economic security, and so on? Or do we respond in the way that the Elise Stefanik's and the J.D. Vance and others say, which is basically we don't need that social safety net, move things back to the states and deregulate everything and let the market decide, which, lift every boat. Mm-hmm. Reagan tried that. It didn't work. So I do think the question is, will we knit together a coalition? But I think we have much more urgent issues. We have, yesterday two military planes off of a ship crashing. Why is that happening? What's happening to our military? Are they being run efficiently and effectively, or have they been taken astray? What's going on with them? How are our troops going to be fed? How are our, how's our government going to run? Which direction are we going to go in healthcare? What are we going to do with ICE agents? There's some, news on the reshuffling of what's happening, where they're trying to put people who are much more intensive in ICE.
Aggressive
around the country. What's going to be response to that? I mean, I do think there are a whole host of these issues across the board. We have this major storm. They slashed NOAA's budget, and they slashed climate change budgets. Is this storm that we're...
But, Teresa, the stock market is booming. The rich are getting richer.
But the divide is getting bigger, though.
Yes,
the divide
right.
is getting bigger. But I know
that was
I'm a policy.
Sarcasm.
No,
I
understand that. But so I do think this we're at this inflection
exactly.
point.
Exactly.
You see, we don't even know what we're in right now.
I think that's exactly. where some of the leverage might come. You might be able to say something like, if you want to look at the biggest jump in per capita income in the United States from year on to year on, it came when the tax rates were much higher than they are now. Economic performance at that top level is one thing, but lifting the entire society up. I mean, those used to be talking points that are just getting lost
and
in the sauce.
And Democrats, I mean, you look over data over decades, Democrats balanced the budgets more than Republicans, right? Republicans blew, the top off the deficits, right?
That's right.
And so... What's the history here? And what for them, it's all about the tax breaks and the grifting. And so we're at an inflection point where we have to decide. And you don't have to get all the Republicans. Can you get five Republicans in these states to say, we agree with you, Democrats. We cannot allow the dismantling of our healthcare system, because it's the subsidies right now on Obamacare, but the ripple effect is going to be much broader than that into everybody's premiums, just like these SNAP benefits. It will affect those particular families, but the economic ripple effect is going to run through the farming community, and it's going to run, it is running through the food delivery community as well. And so, you know, what direction, where are we going to go as a country?
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue and finish up the show for this Tuesday morning. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We always welcome your letters. Keep them short. Keep them to the point. We'll get to as many as possible. Last call on those, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. And we welcome you as always. Get your letters in. Last call on those, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Does anybody want to say anything else about the last subject before we move on? Hearing none. All right. We go to the Hurricane Melissa story, which, of course, is one of those stories that I think a lot of times these stories are so difficult to talk about because it's just horrific and horrible. And once you said it's horrific and horrible, you know. But I think in this case, there are some things to look at. Hurricane Melissa is stronger than Katrina, nears landfall in Jamaica. The National Hurricane Center warned those in the Category 5 storm's path to seek shelter, saying it was the last chance to protect your life. The update that I am reading to you is from the New York Times and came out just 3 minutes ago. The hurricane has threatened catastrophic winds, deadly floods, and landslides in Jamaica's southern coast on Tuesday morning, nearing landfall as a Category 5 storm with 185 miles per hour winds, only 5 miles short of the most intense Atlantic hurricane on record. The storm's intensification with sustained winds stronger than those of Hurricane Katrina at its peak came with dire warnings from officials. Forecasters from the U.S. National Weather Service warned people in the hurricane's path on Tuesday morning that this was the last chance to protect your life. More intense than the Category 5 strength of Katrina, which pummeled New Orleans in 2005, Melissa is now the fifth strongest hurricane on record ever in the Atlantic Ocean. The National Hurricane Center in Miami predicted Melissa would make landfall on Tuesday morning. Jamaica's capital, Kingston, is out of the direct path of the storm, but rain and wind were lashing windows and the streets were mostly deserted. The winds in Melissa's eyewall are so strong that they could cause total structural failure and widespread power and communication outages. The Hurricane Center said on Monday at least 3 people have died in connection to preparations for the storm and 13 others were injured. Officials said forecasters were predicting rains measured in feet, not inches, for Jamaica and other Caribbean nations this week.
This is the third Category 5 storm we've had this season. That's unusual. Jamaica has never been hit directly, had landfall on a Cat 5. This is going to be catastrophic. That phrase, total structural failure, is the worst thing you can possibly hear if you're a government and facing this. And, of course, this all comes about because the ocean waters are so much warmer. You know, the hurricane is formed after warm air rising and cools and condenses, and then the earth's spin turns it into thunderstorms. The problem here is that the low vertical wind shear that is absolutely essential to make hurricanes form is easier to form when the waters are so warm. And the attendant problems, of course, are that with climate change, we have rising sea levels. And so the storm surge in Jamaica is going to be worse probably than the winds. It's just going to devastate this island. And we're going to have storm after storm after storm like this until we wake up and do something about climate change.
The World Food Program has positioned 450 metric tons of food in Haiti in advance of the hurricane, a fraction of the amount that the United Nations agency normally has on standby in a natural disaster there. It said the agency is financed by donors, many of which have shifted priorities to Gaza and Ukraine, which is an interesting fact that I thought in this. Also, National Weather Service data gathering and updates continue despite the U.S. government shutdown because they are considered essential for public safety. However, the Weather Service is already operating at reduced staffing after the Trump administration slashed the number of employees at many of the agencies traditionally responsible for planning for and responding to natural disasters.
Yeah, I think the budget cuts is where I wanted to go with this, the administration cuts, because they, quote-unquote, clawed back money from NOAA. I remember, of course, Musk went in with his folks, and they just indiscriminately cut the NOAA staff and drove people out, and some had to be called back. The Trump proposed budget, proposed deep cuts in the NOAA budget. Even the Republicans pushed back on that. But still, what they did is the Lutnick, who's the head of Commerce Department, he reportedly just, there were all these funding. He said he had to sign off on everything of $100,000 or more. I'm getting into the weeds here. But so we just held them on his desks, millions and millions of dollars in funding. They have cut 14% from the research budget. So but this is a reminder of how important the function of NOAA is. And to have this research and have this capacity around the country and our links to others around the world.
I was going to say, it's not just
and
the country.
It's around the world, right? Yeah, it's a global service, yeah. And it's essential. And so, again, this is which direction do we want to go here? And it shows to know these storms. And the other is the World Food Program. Remember, the U.S. cut funding for the World Food Program as well. And think of this if it were hitting the U.S., which it looks like it might not, but cut funding for FEMA and the FEMA response. There's a lot of concern. Remember the FEMA workers. Mm-hmm. They spoke out publicly a couple weeks ago saying we're not prepared to respond in an emergency. And so the question is, again, where are we going to go as a country? Are we okay with that? Are we okay with dismantling NOAA and climate change? As you say, Bob, and the Biden administration made enormous progress on moving us forward on climate change. President's, you know, meeting with Xi tomorrow, China, going way out ahead on addressing climate change issues. Europe, going way out ahead. We're being set back in our climate agenda.
Yeah, I hope that the U.S. government would step in and come to the aid of Jamaica after this. And that would be a difficult thing because it might take an act of Congress to appropriate funds, which might be the ordinary way that we would respond when our neighbors, you know, we're being very militaristic in the Caribbean right now. It would be nice to see us be more humanistic. And they will definitely need a pouring of aid. And as you said, Teresa, this is a wake-up call. We can't be underfunding FEMA. We can't be underfunding NOAA. These are important agencies that are important to our place in the world. And you know, you whether or not it's what percentage of it is because of man-made climate change or just trends, that's another debate. We aren't prepared for it, and it's coming.
It seems that it is difficult for the president to make remarks basically admitting that he is a climate denier and then not addressing these issues that are brought up by what is happening to our climate. And I understand, you know, the politics of that, but as you said, Mike, with NOAA and FEMA and other programs, these are very, very serious programs for us and for around the world.
Yeah, and one of the things that is interesting to me here, I mean, governments first organized because of weather. You had to pool your resources to have a community be protected from the from the travesties of weather. And this is a place where the government has always had a role. So it's going to be interesting to see how Trump does handle this going forward.
And also, the clean energy agenda was also U.S. manufacturing resurgence agenda, right? Mm-hmm. It was it just like the infrastructure investments were had a positive impact. These were investments not only in something that was important, but also helped improve the economy. And so a walking away from the solar investments or the wind investments or the others not only sets us back in terms of addressing climate change, but it also sets back our efforts to try to regrow, reshore the U.S. manufacturing economy. As well. There were a lot of jobs, yeah. A lot of jobs tied to investment in clean energy.
Absolutely. And we had the chance to do two things. One with chips, which should have just flooded the market with chips. We had that opportunity. And the other was to become the leader in EV battery production.
Right.
And
mm-hmm.
that would have been a huge boost to the manufacturing center in this country. And we just punted it to China.
Yeah, China is flooding Europe, flooding South America with cheap, very efficient running electric vehicles, and we're rescinding funding for that very purpose here.
No, we aren't. The Trump administration.
Well, I mean,
no, I know,
it's
I know.
It's happening
know.
In the United States.
No, I know, I know, I know. But I just think it's important.
Yeah, we as a country are moving away from it, and it's a mistake.
And this is going to keep happening.
Yeah.
And a lot of people here, I think, have family right there. And,
right.
And we really
Absolutely.
Have to. I don't mean to be pulling away from not focusing on the hardship that they're all going to face and the grief there. But I do think it's a reflection of a larger issue that we really have to focus on.
And that issue doesn't know lines on a map.
Right. Right.
Right. And meanwhile, as of July 29th of this year, both the head of the EPA, Lee Zeldin, and the president of the United States said that climate change poses no threat to public health. Hmm. We will end there. All good things must come to an end. I wish we could go 18 innings last night.
Oh my goodness!
I finally gave in about 10 after one. I was like, I tried.
I hung in there to the end, but I wanted the Blue Jays. Oh,
well, I did too. I did too. But well, there you go.
You know, maybe Nick, maybe today.
You all are wonderful. I thank you so much for your time and for your thoughtfulness. A special thanks to Natasha Pernicka for joining us as well.
She was great
for
She's
her.
Awesome.
Appearance, and I thank you all. We'll be back right after this short break.